Chapter 3, Book of Mark. We have, there was one other thing that I wanted to mention on this business of making our methods sort of the Medes and Persians for everybody else. If I do it this way, everybody's got to do it this way. If this is the way I do it, then somebody else has got to. And if people don't do it this way, they're out of the will of God. And navigators are great ones to think that way. We think, boy, if I, you know, well, why aren't they getting 3 a week? Or, you know, all this new thing they got out. Now, why aren't they getting 2 a week, it'll turn out to be? You know, if people are only getting 2 a week, it was sin. Now, it is 2 a week or, you know, it's sin or something. It just depends on how we happen, what mood we'd be in and what our materials happen to read that particular year. But this whole business of if they don't do it our way or think like we think or use the jargon we use or the words we use or whatever, there's something wrong with them. If we operate on the basis of principle, we're safe. But if we get hung up on methods and what we do, see, and many of you are going to go back to campus now, and you've got certain ideas you've picked up here during this summer. If you go back to campus now all hung up on some method that has blessed your life and try to foist that off on everybody else in sight, what's going to happen? Very likely you're going to get in trouble. Because that may not be the way God is leading them. And admittedly, you know, that the same suit of clothes does not fit every man, but there are certain basics that we know are right, but the application of those basics can be different in each individual case. So that's what the Pharisees were all hung up here on, and I could give you some interesting scriptures on this, but just, you know, leave it with that, because we didn't get very far so far in our little reading of the book of Mark together. Okay, chapter 3. Is a very key part in the book of Mark, because verse 14 is where Jesus chooses those with whom he will minister until his death. And then he will minister through them and through the people that they reach and the people that they reach right until this very moment. So this little gang that he gathers together here are a very strategic bunch of people. Verse 14 says, he ordained 12 that they should be with him and that he might send them forth to preach. Now, these 12 that he ordained, it says in the book of Luke, in fact, you might want to turn to that. Book of Luke, chapter 6, verse 12 is the good key reference on that verse. It says, it came to pass in those days that he went out into a mountain to pray and continued all night in prayer to God. And when it was day, he called unto him his disciples, and of them he chose 12. Whom he also named apostles. So this was a very strategic, key decision that he was going to make, and he spent all night in prayer prior to making that decision. Now then, application. What we do with our lives, how we invest this forthcoming year, certain key crossroads that we come to, what is our approach to finding the will of God on the matter? Running around like a chicken with her head cut off, asking this guy, seeing what he says? Of course, counsel is important, especially for a new Christian. It is very important for a new Christian to sit down and talk it over with some guys a little older in the Lord and already walked down that line. But when people approach your maturity, what most of you are, the time will come when what you need to do is get off on that hill and sit down with God and pray it through. And seek God's mind on the matter and get your convictions from God. And I can say that in this group because I know that most of you are mature people and you've walked with the Lord for a number of years. If I were at Maranatha, I wouldn't, you know, I'd tell you to go off and pray, but I'd also kind of give you some heavy counsel about getting with someone and talking it over. Because that is the way God normally needs the very young, is through the counsel of an older guy or gal. But in your case, Jesus' pattern here is very, very important to remember. Just getting alone with God and praying and seeking the mind of God. And that's something I think that many people are weak on. They don't really understand that and the importance of it. Well, he chose these people and he had a certain basis upon which to choose them. The scripture says, not a novice, lest being lifted up with pride, he fall in a snare, you know. So it can't be a novice. These people could not be novices. So he had that guideline, so he had that principle to go on. Not a novice, lest being lifted up with pride, See, pride is a very deadly sin. Pride is that sin that changes angels into devils. And so you couldn't let them fall into pride. Or it says, lest these also first be proved. That is why when the demoniac of Gadara in Mark 5, when this demon-possessed man living in the tombs of, among the Gadarenes, when he was finally converted to Christ and was sitting at his feet and asked Jesus, well, let me go with you now, like these that I see going with you. And he said, no, you go on back now and, you know, get involved with your own folk back there and so on. Because he had not proven this man. This was not someone that he had tested and seen over a period of time. So this particular job here that Jesus called these men to do, this was very, very important to get the right men. So he had certain principles that he went on, and then he spent a lot of time in prayer. Application. I have sat on personnel boards in the Navigator ministry. And we get a request from somebody overseas, and they say, we need a man with such and such and such a qualifications. So we think, well, let's see. Let us pray about that now. Let's think that through. And then, of course, we have certain guidelines that guide us and certain principles that we operate on. And see, it brings it right down to home where we live. We have certain selections to make and certain recommendations to make. If you're wondering how to know if you're called to the Navigator, then I can give you four very simple things on that if you'd like to jot them down. One is the conviction in your own heart. Is this what God wants me to do? And having a firm, deep conviction in your own heart. Secondly, is a deep conviction on the behalf of the navigators. They have to be convinced also. And so you have to have both, you see, and that's very healthy because one spirit leads us all. Thank God for that. He's not, you know, the Spirit of God is not going to lead you this way and the navigators this way because one spirit's in charge of this whole operation, we trust. So there has to be this mutual conviction of heart. Then the third thing is the willingness and the eagerness to undertake the necessary preparation. There must be certain preparation take place before a guy will ever fit this outfit. Because we function on the basis of vision and what is in a man's heart. See, I can name mission boards for you that send people overseas, and do you know how they guide what that guy does day by day? Each month he sends a report. He did this much, he did this, he did this, he did this. And so he gets over there, and he looks at his chart, and he thinks, ah, so they want me to, so then he goes and does that. Then it's, ah, you know, and so he's guided by the reports that he sends in. Navigators say, not so. We help a guy and work with a guy, and he lives in somebody's basement. He comes to Glen Eyrie and, you know, works on the crew, and he does this and that and the other thing, and he's around for a long time. And so by the time this guy gets overseas, we know what's in his heart. He can't do anything but do that, or it'd drive him nuts. See? He has to do this. See, I have a guy like, like Paul Drake, who lives here in Colorado Springs. Do you think he sends me, do you think I haven't been sending me any reports of what he's doing or anything, you know, or think I, you know? I know what he's doing. If he's not out winning men to Christ and discipling men, he's, you know, he's out of his tree. He's, you know, and he can't take it. He's got to be doing that because it's in his heart. And that generally comes through time and exposure and undertaking the necessary preparation. Then the fourth thing I jotted down here is just the blessing of God upon his life in these particular areas. Whether or not the fellow shows fruit in, you know, evangelism and whether or not he's raising up disciples and so on. And just seeing how it goes. Well, Jesus had certain principles that he functioned with, and prayer was a prime one. Then in chapter 4, he has these people around, these disciples and these apostles, and he's teaching them down by the seaside, as I mentioned earlier. And so this whole crowd comes around, and so he teaches them this parable of the sower. And so then they come to him and they say, you know, what does it all mean? So verse 14, he explains it to them. The sower soweth the word. And something that we've learned over the years is that good fruit comes from the sowing of good seed. And that means both people and the Bible. Because good seed, interestingly enough, is referred to in two ways in the Scriptures. One, it is people, and you've all heard Warren talk about this. And the other is the Word of God. So you have good seed sowing good seed. You have people out who have, you know, these characteristics in their lives. And they, in turn, are sowing the seed of the Word of God. The sower soweth the Word. And good fruit comes from the sowing of good seed by good seed. And you don't get good fruit any other way. You know, you sow poor seed, and you're likely to get a kind of a mediocre crop. You must sow good seed. Verse 15, and these are they by the wayside when the word is sown, which when they have heard, Satan cometh immediately and taketh away the word that was sown in their hearts. And you've all seen that happen enough. I don't have to go into that. And you know how that works. Verse 16, these are they which are sown by the stony ground, who when they have heard the word immediately receive it with gladness and have no root in themselves, and so endure but for a time. Afterward, when affliction and persecution ariseth for the word's sake, immediately they are offended. And so this is kind of the crowd that hangs around for a little while and then peels off. That, by the way, is why oftentimes in a guy's first year in an area, that first bunch of guys that come around don't really stick. I don't know whether you've seen this or not, but I've been around long enough to see this. And there's two or three reasons for that. One is that there's a certain kind of a guy or gal you meet on campus who are just lonesome. They'll talk to anybody, they'll talk to them. And if they think somebody will sit down and talk to them by the hour, they are happy to sit down and talk to somebody by the hour because no one's ever done that before. They're just kind of lonesome. But here is this navigator out there giving hours and hours and hours of his time, and then it surprises him that somehow this guy does not take that thing and transform it and use it with others. He's just there because he's sort of lonesome and likes to talk to people and just needs companionship. There is another crowd of people that are kind of like in the book of Acts, what will this babbler say? Some guy comes up with a new idea, a new vision, it's, you know, multiplying and producing and reproducing and discipleship and on. He thinks, new doctrine. So he sits and listens to that for a while. And it sounds all good, and he gets all excited, and the guy thinks, good night, amen. So he talks, you know, and then you know what's going to happen? The next year, somebody come along with a new idea. Woo, new idea. You know, what will this babbler say? So he's over here. And you see this going on year after year after year after year. It is very important, if you're going to invest your lives in the lives of people, that you do what Jesus did and spend some time in prayer and really seek the mind of God as to who you'll invest that life with. Because let me tell you something, you've only got one, and it doesn't last very long. And you better be very careful how you use it, because God will hold us accountable to how we use that life. You know? And we have principles that we can operate on here to know what, you know, how to go at that. Because we learn from the life of Jesus, this is what he did. And one guideline is in Isaiah 58. If you pour out your soul to the hungry, the guy who is just starved for the word, he just can't get enough. You know, that's the kind of a guy that you can use and depend on because he's really hungry. Well, anyhow, these people came and went. Verse 18, these are they which are sown among thorns, such as hear the word, and the cares of this world, and the deceitfulness of riches, and the lust of other things, entering and choke the word, and it becometh unfruitful. And the scary thing is that can happen well along in the life of the plant. When I was plowing corn on my brother's farm up in Portsmouth, Iowa, you know, some years ago, with a riding cultivator behind a team of horses, well, we had a guy that lived up on the next farm called Lovejoy. And old Lovejoy, he was kind of a character. And he thought, well, what I'll do this year is I'll have me an experiment. So he waited until the corn got up high enough to cultivate it once, and he went through and cultivated it. Now, in those days, we didn't have the kind of fertilizer they have now and all the techniques that we have now, so you had to kind of space your corn. You know, now you look at a cornfield, it's just cluttered up there. We couldn't do that. We had to kind of space it so the root could get enough to eat on to produce an ear of corn. Well, old Lovejoy decided that he would cultivate it once, and then he would just sort of let the thing go. He thought maybe cultivating it the second time, and then the third time, was kind of a nuisance, kind of a waste of time. So he would experiment in that field. And it was kind of in the back 40, so he didn't ever go out and look at it. So he went out there at the end of summer, and guess what he had? He had ears of corn, all right, but they were about that long. They're called nubbins in Iowa talk. Nubbins. Now, it had grown up, but weeds had grown up right along with it, and even though fruit was produced, it did not bring forth fruit unto perfection. It was a nubbin. And the thing that Jesus is getting at here can happen well along in the life of the plant, even after it's been cultivated for a while and growing up and looking real good, you know? And so these weeds grow up and these thorns grow up and choke the word, and it becometh unfruitful. See, now cares sap my vigor. Do you know what I've learned in personal experience? If I've got something that kind of walks along beside me year by year, that is a big problem and kind of a pressure and trouble to me, there's two or three things I can do to that. But the only thing I can reasonably, logically, spiritually, biblically do with that is to cast that on Jesus. Casting all your care upon Him, for He careth for you. And to cast that on the Lord, because only one person can carry it. Either I carry it or Jesus carries it. And I have learned by personal experience the only way I can maintain my sanity is to cast that on Jesus. See? That it's the only thing you can do. Because cares that I carry around sap my vigor. I find myself slowed down, my shoulders bowed, my head drooping, see, and I find myself plodding through life because my energy is sapped. The cares of this world and the deceitfulness of riches. Now, riches divert my life. Riches divert my faith. Riches divert me into sidetracks. And so I become enamored by something. You know, I see it. Well, it doesn't burden me. It doesn't sap me. It gets me on the wrong track. And I find myself going over fiddling around in something, and I got no business fiddling around with. That's what that can do, the deceitfulness of riches. So the cares of this world, or the deceitfulness of riches, or just the lust of other things, enter again, choke the word, and the whole business becomes fruitful, and you bring forth no fruit to perfection in your life. Oh, maybe a nubbin or two, but nothing to perfection. And that's just something that we must see in the word here and apply. Then it says, and these are they which, verse 20, are sown on good ground, such as hear the word and receive it and bring forth fruit, some 30, some 60, and some 100. By the way, you see these stones up there earlier, they spoiled the root. And then the thorns later on spoiled the fruit. So you got two things working against you, your root system and then how you react to certain things. So we must, you know, maintain our root system in the word and our fellowship with Jesus and so on. Now, whether or not I make it through all this depends upon whether or not I'm sailing for pleasure or sailing for keeps. Whether or not it's my business. See, I went out sailing up in Whidbey Island, off of Whidbey Island, with a guy named Mike Kotecki. Any of you guys know Mike Kotecki? I almost am not here tonight because of that character. We went sailing, see? He gets this Navy boat, we load all this stuff in it, and deep sea fish, and the fish you use for bait out in that crazy water is bigger than the trout you catch up here at Eagle Lake, you know? You got these humongous poles, you know, and all this good stuff. These little dinky boat we're out in, you know? And I discover that the cross current to this thing, you're going on, it's as flat as that rug, and all of a sudden they're white caps, it's big. Seven or eight different currents are going through, called the Alaskan Current. Survival time in that water is 35 minutes if you happen to capsize and get into the thing, you know. Changes 6 degrees from midwinter to midsummer. So with all these statistics in my mind, I go sailing with Mike, you know. And out we go, and he's kind of a bombastic sort anyhow, you know. I didn't seem to know what he was doing except he wanted to do it, so away we go. And so I wake up next morning. We went out to James Island. We did all these things, fought off raccoons all night, trying to steal our food and, you know, sleeping on the ground. And I've done that, sleeping on the ground. That's not really my thing. But anyhow, next morning I wake up and it's fog. You know, good heavens, you couldn't see that. Some of you been to the Northwest? You seen those fogs rolling up there? I mean, they're out of sight. Out of sight is what I mean. So I got to catch a plane. I'm going to Oakland. I got a one-day conference waiting on me down there in Oakland, you know. So I have to catch this plane. So we thought, okay, let's go. So we load up. We wait until after lunch, and it lifts a little bit. We think we'll make it. Okay. So out we go, and we get out into this fog. And you don't know anything. You don't know whether it's going that way or that way, see? Guess what Mike has? No compass. Just sort of a steering wheel and hope for the best. So off we're going, you know. And the currents are going and we're going. And We passed these rocks. Weren't they supposed to be over there? I thought they were supposed to be over there. Well, they were over there when we came. Oh, we're on the wrong side of the rocks. I wonder which way we're really going. So we see a fishing boat. Do you have any idea where this bay is? We think it's that way. Right. So then we turn around and start heading that way, you know. Now, a fog on the ocean, you have no idea which way you're going. There's no landmark, see? We're just flooring it. It is so thick that you cannot see beyond the windshield, so a guy is standing up at the back of this little boat that's about 13 inches deep, peering, you know, and he hollers, "What's that log?" And there's a log as big around as this pulpit floating, you know. So then we turn and go over this way. Might as well go that way as that way, no one knows if we're going anyhow. But we're going along flooring it, and guess what happened? Off of our starboard bow, we hear, and I mean the biggest ship on earth appears on our starboard bow. Now, this is fishing water. This is where you're supposed to go with these little fishing boats, you know, and do little tricks with the little rods and reels. Here's this boat, you know. I mean, a huge, huge boat. It is a combination of the Queen Mary, the Queen Elizabeth, and the King James Version all rolling in one boat, see? What do? Stop! So now we're floating, you know. First we're floating this way, then we're floating this way. I mean, I am prayed up for a month, see? We know we can't go in front of it. No point in trying to beat the thing, you know. It's going by, you know. Let's go behind it. What about the wake? Why, 35 minutes, you know. Oh, well, Mike says, let's floor it around behind that baby. We go around behind that thing and just continue to floor it in what we hope is some direction. And the minute we get beyond that boat, we break out into the sky as clear as this, and right in front of us is the harbor. Right dead in front of us is where we're right supposed to be. Well, I wouldn't do that for a living. You know, that is not my thing. Something I'm ready to head for harbor and hang it up, see. Now, if I were in a ship and that was my business and fog came along or a storm came up or whatever and I'm out after bring back a load of bananas, guess what I do? Floor it and continue. I bring back the rotten or the good bananas, you know. I bring the bananas back. It depends upon whether or not a man is sailing for business or just for pleasure. And it seems to me that some guys or gals launch out of the Christian life kind of as a lark, kind of just out there because it's kind of a, you know, other guys mean business so that when storms come or fogs come or whatever comes, they press ahead and do it. But the guy's just out sailing for pleasure, heads for port. These people here, verse 20, they were in it for keeps. They meant business. They had dedicated themselves to it 100% totally, and they pressed ahead. And they went through fogs, and they went through storms, and they went through everything else. But it says of these people, and these are they which are sown on good ground, such as hear the word, and receive it some 30, and bring forth fruit, some 30-fold, some 60, and some 100. You know, it was their whole life. And that's all they did. Others, a thorn would rise, or a stone, or something, you know, and they never did make it. But not that crowd. It depends upon your heart's dedication. Are you in it because you mean business and this is what you've given your life to? Or is it just something that we're doing because it seems to be the thing to do? Because my area rep would raise his eyebrow if I didn't or something, see? Okay, chapter 5, you have a little lesson on faith here. And, boy, there's so much in this that I want to get to, I think. Well, let me just bring up one thing in chapter 5. It's this business of this girl who was sick. Verse 22. In this chapter, by the way, you've got three people with two stories. And the three people involved, one's this demoniac that I mentioned earlier, and then the second thing is this little girl. And this little girl, the story begins with Jairus coming to Jesus in verse 22. And he besought him greatly, "My little daughter lieth at the point of death. I pray thee, come and lay thy hands on her, that she may be healed, and she shall live." That's what you call a statement of faith. He gives out a pure, crystal clear, sterling silver statement of faith. If you come, lay your hand on that girl, she shall live. Great. Verse 24, Jesus went with him. Can you imagine how his heart leaped at that? the excitement in the heart of Jairus when he knew that if he could, first of all, if he could find Jesus, secondly, if he could get to him, thirdly, if he could speak to him, and then actually Jesus would actually come with him. And Jesus came with him. There was a great leap of joy and happiness and all like that. She shall live. And so Jesus went with him. And much people followed him. And a certain woman, which had an issue of blood 12 years and had suffered many things of many physicians, had spent all that she had, it was nothing better, but rather grew worse. Mark does not have too much confidence in the medical profession here. He says all these doctors, all she ever did was spend all her money and didn't help her one bit. In fact, everything that did it or just made her get worse. Verse 27, when she had heard of Jesus, came in the press behind, touched his garment. For she said, if I just touch his clothes, I shall be made whole. And straightway the fountain of her blood was dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of the plague. And immediately Jesus, knowing that in himself that virtue had gone out of him, turned him about in the press and said, who touched my clothes? And his disciples get a little bit uptight at this point. They say, who touched your clothes? Everybody touches your clothes. You're going along here, you're being jostled by a Middle Eastern crowd, you know, bang, 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 down the road. All these people are jostling and bumping and pushing, and the press is all around him. And so he wants to know, who touched me? Everybody touched you, you know. What do you mean, who touched you? That's what they ask him. Verse 31, his disciples said to him, thou seest the multitude thronging thee, and thou sayest, who touched thee? What kind of a question is that? But he knew what he was asking. He looked round about to see her that had done this thing. But the woman, fearing and trembling, knowing what was done in her, came and fell down before him and told him all the truth. And he said, her daughter, thy faith hath made thee whole, and go in peace, and behold thy... Now, during this time, guess what Jairus is doing? Pacing the floor. He knew that if he could just get Jesus to his daughter, who was not just sick, she is at the point of death. The point of death. She is on the verge of dying. Jesus is on his way to the house, and now here he is standing, having this big conversation with this woman over here, who, you know, and by the way, have you ever had a woman tell you about her infirmities? You know, and he has this big conversation going on and on about, right, I see, okay, good, all right, I understand. 12 years she's had this thing, you know, maybe you've never had this experience, but women have a way of carrying on and on and on, so. And Jairus is over here thinking, good grief. I mean, I know what's going to happen. We almost had the thing cooled, you know. It was almost set. He was coming, and now here he stands. Talking to this woman. And, you know, she spent her life. My young daughter is, you know, 12 years old. She's got her whole life in front of her. And here this old woman is taking up all his time. And I know, and you're right. You guessed it. And when he yet spake, there came from the ruler of the synagogue's house certain which said, thy daughter is dead. Why troublest thou the master any further? I knew it. I mean, we had the thing going, right? He was coming. And now this old woman comes along and sidetracks him. And all they did was have this conversation anyhow. And as soon, verse 36, as soon as Jesus heard that word which is spoken, he said unto the ruler of the synagogue, be not afraid, only believe. Believe what? The girl is dead. I mean, I have given a clear, ringing statement of faith earlier in this chapter, if you may remember. I have given my statement of faith. I have told you, you know, what I believe. And now you give out some religious platitude. Be not afraid, only believe. Big deal. The girl is dead. It's all over. What is there left to believe? I'll tell you what there's left to believe. There is left to believe that God can do the impossible. That's what's left to believe, and that's all that's left to believe. And one of these days, God will bring you to the point where that's all there is left for you to believe. There'll be no reason to believe. There'll be no basis for belief. You'll just hang on by faith that God will do it. And there's no reason to believe it. There's no logic behind it. You couldn't prove it. In fact, every circumstance in the world would militate against it. And Jesus will come to you and he will say, be not afraid, only believe. And then is when things begin to happen. You either do or you don't. You either trust him or you don't. You either believe that God can do the impossible, or you say, believe what? You know, that's the story, and that's one of the stories, and the other is a kind of an exciting story. You know, this is kind of a dull story, but the other one is really exciting in Mark 5. If you ever get a chance to read the other one sometime, wise. Got a lot of good stuff in it. Verse 40, they laughed him to scorn when he came and said, she's only asleep. But then he came, and straightway the damsel arose and walked. For she was of age 12 years old, and they were astonished with a great astonishment. You better believe it, they were astonished at a great astonishment. Jesus had just done something. And when Jesus does it, people get astonished. You know, they really get shook when Jesus steps into the middle of the picture. Well, chapter 6, you have a little lesson on training. Chapter 6 says, and he went out from thence and came into his own country, and his disciples followed him. And when the Sabbath day was come, he began to teach in the synagogue, and many hearing him were astonished, saying, from whence hath this man these things? And what wisdom is this which is given unto him, that even such mighty works are wrought by his hands? Is not this the carpenter, the son of Mary, the brother of James and Joseph and Judah and Simon, and not his sisters here with us? And they were offended at him. Right. How can we believe this man? Here he comes and he starts teaching. Why? There's no reason to believe this man. While we know everything about him, we know his mother, we know his father, we know where he came from, we know where he was born, we know all of his relatives, we know everything. How can we believe him? Where does he have this kind of wisdom? We can't believe him because we know all about him. We know his background and everything. John 9:29. Beginning with verse 28 says, then they reviled him and said, thou art his disciple, but we are Moses' disciples. We know that God spake unto Moses. As for this fellow, we know not from whence he is. How do you expect us to believe this fellow? We don't know anything about him. We don't know his background. We don't know who his father was. We don't know who his mother was. We don't know his sisters. We don't know his brothers. We don't know what town he was born in. How can you expect us to believe on this fellow? We don't know anything about him. Over here they say, how can you expect us to believe this fellow? We know everything about him. Disbelief needs no rationale. If a man is going to disbelieve, he's going to disbelieve, logic or no logic. That's why in witnessing for Christ, the greatest thing you can do is forget all your pat answers and your pat logic and your pat little things that you go through to bring a person to a place where, you know, just pray. Get before God and pray and ask God to work in his heart. Because all the logic in the world will not bring a man to Christ. They don't, you know, just none of that. What brings a person to Christ is the Holy Spirit of God in answer to prayer. So from one who has done some evangelism and made but every mistake in the world, I commend to you, get on your knees and pray and watch God work. Well, they ask, isn't that this the carpenter? See, they were astonished that he had this wisdom. He'd hadn't been to school. See, he had the power to do and he had the wisdom to teach. Lauren's always talking about doing and teaching. That's what Jesus said. He had the power to do it. He had the wisdom to teach it. And they were astonished at that. Where did he get that? Verse 5 says, and he can bear to no mighty work, save he laid his hands on a few sick folk and healed them. By the way, the healing of the body is not a mighty work. Because it says here, he could there do no mighty work, save he laid his hands on a few sick folk and healed them. Well, verse 7, and he called unto him the 12 and began to send them forth two by two and gave them power over unclean spirits. And then he gives them a few principles to guide on, and out they go. See, Jesus had prepared his men in two basic ways. One, by taking them with him. See, chapter 6, verse 1, his disciples follow him. By taking them with him. And fellowship with Christ is a prerequisite to service for Christ. Intimate fellowship with Christ is a prerequisite for any kind of effective service for Christ. That still follows. And also, the application we can draw from that is that we, who are out ministering in the name of Christ, can learn something about how to help people grow. Take them with us. Let them watch. Let them see. The guy that was a great influence on me in my early Christian life was a man named Don Rosenberger. And Don Rosenberger was led to Christ by a guy named Kenny Waters, and then Don led a guy to Christ to, Kenny Waters. And then when Don led this other fellow to Christ, he passed on some things that Kenny had taught him. But you know how Don Rosenberger learned to pray? After Don had come to the Lord, he went to Kenny and said, I'm new Christian now, what'll I do? So he went down to the chow hall, and the whole side of the chow hall was up with X's and charts and things along, and everybody had their name there. And it was how many, if they'd gotten their Bible study, it was kind of out in the open in those days over in Pearl Harbor. And they kind of checked if they got their verses memorized, and everyone kind of, so they could see who was kind of proving unfaithful and prayed for them, and it was kind of set up on the wall. So Don says, can I get my name up there? Yeah, so he put his name up, and he thought, good night, here I am clear back here, and some of these guys are way, halfway around the room. He thought, do I have to memorize 3 a week? No. So he memorized 1,000 verses first year as a Christian. So he kind of catch up, because, of course, Don has a very healthy mind, so it didn't hurt him too much to do that. And so on. Well, then he thinks about, that he sees this prayer thing, but isn't quite sure what that's all about. So in the evenings, he sees Kenny Waters leave the place and go up on this side of the hill. So he goes up and he kind of sneaks up and watches Kenny. And Kenny lays down on the grass, puts his arms out, puts his head back, and Don can see his lips moving. He thinks, he's praying. He kind of sneaks in closer and hears him saying a few words in prayer. So the next night, Don goes on, lays down, and starts that. And he did that for the rest of the time he was in the Navy. He learned to pray by watching, what Kenny did. I encourage you, that if you're going to teach a guy, if you want to build prayer in a guy's life, start praying. Pray with him. Pray for him. Have a quiet time with him. With him, you see, that's what Jesus did. Secondly, he taught them. He took them with him, and then he would sit down occasionally and just teach them. And over in the Gospels you find, and he taught the disciples. And he taught the disciples. He took time to teach the Word, teaching them. Now, the man who will be a teacher must first be a learner, because you learn to teach by being taught. You learn to lead by following. This is God's method. But Jesus taught these men. They learned, and they in turn went and taught. Then it was time for them to go out and gain some experience in the field, which would do two things for them, which is what he did for them here. One, it would raise them above their present abilities, obviously, but more than that, it would give them a greater capacity to learn more. See, if you have a person around, and he's just around and around and around, and you're forever showing him and teaching him and training him and, going through all these tricks that we do, pretty soon that person becomes spiritually stuck. He just, you can't take anymore. The way to raise that guy above his present ability is to get him out in the battle where he gets, a few knocks and a few bumps and so on and faces the thing. And secondly, what that will do is it will increase his capacity. Because when he comes back, he'll say, I am ready to learn some more. And that's exactly what happened with these men. This was a strategic time in their training to raise them above their present ability and enlarge their capacity. Because he'd been teaching them some pretty heavy stuff along the line, and it was now time to get them out and get them kind of going. So that's what he did here. Then in verse 30 says, and the apostles gathered themselves together unto Jesus and told him all things, both what they had done and what they had taught. What did they see in the life of Jesus? A doer and a teacher. So guess what they did when they went out? They did and they taught. They were doers and teachers. You see? Monkey see, monkey do. It's as simple as that. If we want to see people doing certain things, we ourselves must be setting the pace and being involved in that very thing ourselves. Because that's exactly what they did. And so they came back and they compared notes and so on, And they told him all things, both what they had done and what they had taught. By the way, I shared with you my application in one of the former chapters. Here's my application for this. I must never do anything or teach anything that I don't want Jesus to know about and I'd be willing to share with him. I must never do anything but what I am eager to sit down and share it with Jesus. I must never do anything or teach anything but what I am hot to sit down and share that with Jesus. Because here it says, the apostles gathered themselves together unto Jesus and told him all things, both what they had done and what they had taught. Well, uh, There's some things toward the back that I want to get to, so let's turn to chapter 8. Chapter 8 says, "In those days, the multitude being very great and having nothing to eat, Jesus called his disciples unto him and said unto him," by the way, if you're making little notes, this is called a lesson in leadership, if you're making a topic. I have compassion on the multitude because they have now been with me 3 days and have nothing to eat. And if I send them away fasting to their own houses, they will faint by the way, for various ones came from afar." Jesus is out teaching the people. They've been at it 3 days now. Someone comes to him and says, "You know, if we keep this up, these people are all going to fall off their chairs. They're going to faint. They're hungry, and they need something to eat." And Jesus said, "Need something to eat? Listen, let me tell you about my own experience. I went 40 days and 40 nights without food. And I know what capacities of people are, because I have done it. And therefore, if I can go 40 days and 40 nights without food, and have a good battle with the devil when it's all over and come out victorious, so can they. Don't talk to me about being hungry after 3 days." It never entered his mind. Do you know what he did? He had compassion on these people and was hot to get them some food. There are some people, in just their makeup, can do a lot more than others can. And so just in the nature of things, they sort of become the leaders of things. And what guys like that must learn is that everybody is not put together that way. And their capacities and their abilities and their stamina and all the rest is not the same. And so what we must do, and I assume, you know, if you've been around the Navigators long enough to be in a second level program, when I say we, I mean we, what we must do is learn how to set the pace for people and lead them gently as Jesus does and be concerned for them. And if they come to us with some kind of a hang-up or problem, to recognize the fact that people have hang-ups and have problems like that. I may have never had it in my life. It may never occurred to me. I may have never even thought about such a thing, see? But the fact that it didn't happen to me doesn't mean that it's not happening to him. Lesson in leadership. If you're thinking about, you know, maybe a campus ministry or something like that, be alert to the fact that there's going to be some people on that team that are just not as alert and bright and sharp and driving and all the rest as others. And pace setting is not outrunning everybody. Where'd he go? He's setting the pace. I can't even see him, you know. That's not setting the pace. That's just outrunning people, you know. Had nothing to do with pace setting. Well, let's see here. Let's go up to chapter 8, verse 31. "He began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected of the elders and of the chief priests and the scribes and be killed and after 3 days rise again." Not crowned, but crucified. This is going to come as kind of a shock to them now, you know. Going to be kind of a shock. Because some of these people at this point believe that he was going to wear a crown. But he is now about ready to teach them that he's going to be wearing a crown of thorns. And a cross is going to be involved. So he shares that with them. Well, now Peter does his usual thing. See? "And he spake this that saying openly. And Peter took him and began to rebuke him." Peter operating on the basis of logic. This is not an impetuous, sort of an unthought-through statement by Peter, I don't think. I think Peter made this statement on the basis of logic. Peter thinks to himself, well, see, he says he's going to be killed. So Peter begins to review. How? "It is obvious by this time that he is the master of wind and storm and disease and death and the devil. What on earth can possibly touch him?" What could possibly touch him? He has overcome disease. He is the master of death. He has stilled the storm. He has taken the demoniac, in whom was 10,000 demons, and was the master of that with a word. The devil. I mean, what could possibly touch him? So Peter thinks, oh, you know. Verse 33, when he had turned about and looked upon his disciples, he rebuked Peter, saying, Get thee behind me, Satan, for thou savorest not the things that be of God, but the things that be of men. There's only one way this is ever going to happen, and that is if he voluntarily lays his life down by himself. No storm can overcome him. No demon, no devil. Death certainly hasn't, because he's proven the master of death. No disease. He's healed diseases of every kind and description, everything that was on the scene at the time. He healed that. There's only going to be one thing that's going to cause Jesus to do this. And that is if he voluntarily lays his own life down. And that's exactly what he did. And like Paul Simon wrote, as a bridge over troubled waters. And by the way, I'm sure you know that when Johnny Carson asked him about it, Paul Simon said, yes, I was talking about Jesus. You know the Simon and Garfunkel record, like a bridge over troubled waters. Yes, I was talking about Jesus. Like a bridge over troubled waters. You know, he laid himself down for us. This is the only way it could ever happen. And that was what God had in mind. Logically, Peter could disprove the whole thing. It couldn't happen. But he didn't understand from God's vantage point that God had you and me in mind. You know? And Jesus was going to lay his life down for the likes of us. Which he did. Which comes up a little later. Well, let's see. What else have I got jotted down here? Let's skip over to chapter 14. Because the time draws nigh, and we got a lot to cover here yet. I'm sorry, gang. I got carried away at the first there, and there's some things that I wanted to share, but we'll have to do it another time. In chapter 14, verse 3, there's a great lesson in ministry here for us, and it can escape you. Unless you kind of read between the lines. 14:3 says, And being in Bethany in the house of Simon the leper, as he sat at meat, there came a woman having an alabaster box of ointment of spikenard, very precious, and she brake the box and poured it on his head. And there were some that had indignation within themselves, saying, Why was this waste made? By the way, an inflammatory word. You could have just well used use there. You know. Why is this use of this ointment like this? But it was waste. There's a way to use speech that kind of inflames, and this is a typical illustration of it. Verse 5, For it might have been sold for more than 300 pence, and the given to the poor. And they murmured against her. And Jesus said, Let her alone. Why trouble ye her? For she hath wrought a good work on me. For ye have the poor with you always, and whensoever you may do good to them, but me ye have not always. She hath done what she could. By the way, great thought. She had done what she could. But he goes on to say, She has come aforehand to anoint my body to the burying. Way, way up here, in the early part of Mark, he had begun to talk about his death. He was making his way to Jerusalem now, going to Jerusalem. He had been down in Galilee all this time, you recall, in his public ministry. And by the way, the interesting thing is, when he got to Jerusalem and went into that temple, he acted like he owned the place. You know? He walked in and began to throw people out. He had been in Galilee all this time. He walked in the temple and that's why he owned it. And, you know, which of course he did. Well, he's going along now, going to Jerusalem, and this is on his mind. The fact that he is going to die is on his mind. And he was a man, you recall. See, the first heresy of the Christian church was not that Jesus was not the Son of God. The first heresy was that he wasn't a man. They couldn't believe that he was a man. And so this heresy arose that said he was not human, he was not a man. But Jesus was a man. And he's going along now and he's thinking about this. And it's on his mind. He's thinking of dying. And he knows what's going to happen. And he's thinking about it. And it's weighing on him a little bit. You can tell this because it kind of comes out here. She hath anointed my body to the burying. They're going to bury me one of these days. But this impending death, this problem that he carried around in his mind all these weeks and months, did not cause him to become a recluse and go hide away somewhere and just sort of sit around and mope about his troubles. He maintained contact with people. He maintained his ministry. It did not cause him to run and hide and sort of hang it up, saying, well, if they only knew, they'd know why I was doing this, you see. That didn't enter his mind. He maintained his contact with people because people still needed what he had. And so he was out giving it to them and sharing his life with people. Application. There's going to be some times come along in your lives when the only thing you'll want to do is run and hide. That'll be all you will want to do. You'll just want to sit down and hide. You won't want to talk to people. You'll just want to sort of... And even some of you who have a world on your heart, and you get that young, fiery spirit, see, that burns in the hearts of the fellows and gals your age, and you're thinking about a world for Jesus and getting out and being missionary someplace in a hard spot. You know, I'm great. Keep pressing in that direction. That's right. Some of you will have something face you someday when those of you that carry the world and a world vision in your heart will suddenly be consumed with self. And that's all you'll be able to think about. If you let yourself react that way, which Jesus didn't, because he knew that there were still people out and around who needed his life and needed his ministry, and he gave it to them. And so for whatever it's worth, why, that may well come your way. In fact, I suppose it will. I don't know many people that escape that kind of stuff. Turn with me to chapter 16. In chapter 16, there's a great, great lesson here . I was going to say another lesson in leadership, but actually it's just a lesson in living. It says, when the Sabbath day was past, Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James, and Salome brought sweet spices, and they might come and anoint him. And very early in the morning, in the first day of the week, there came unto the sepulchre at the rising of the sun. And they said among themselves, who shall roll away the stone from the door of the sepulchre? As you know, I do my Bible study in the margin of my Bible. So I jotted down in the margin of my Bible here. It's just like a woman. It's exactly like a woman. Had this been a navigator, a gentleman navigator here, he would have thought it out very carefully. He would have risen in the morning and he would have said, well, let's see. We should anoint the body, right? Let us think through. I know all the details. There's a stone in front of there. How about that? A stone. The stone is probably about the size of this thing right here, and it's kind of rolled over there in front. And there it is. It took, you know, quite a gang of soldiers to roll in there. There's no point, obviously, in my going to anoint the body, because the body is behind that stone, and I cannot move the stone. Therefore, my logic and all of my reasoning and my thinking through on the problem have led me to do the right thing. And you go and bag it some more. That is what a gentleman navigator would have done at this point. But these women, they don't think that way, see? They get up and they start out with the ointment and say, well, I wonder how we're going to get that stone, you know? They knew a stone was there, but it never occurred to them, you know, they're just going to go do it. Well, I say to myself, thank God for that, you know? Thank God for that. Whenever we get all hung up on the means whereby and lose the fact of God, we are really off track. This has been typical of the great men of God all through the ages. The young lad is out shopping, and the axe head falls off into the water, and the water is deep. So he goes to his area rep. I've lost the axe head. His area rep would have said, well, let us think about it now for a moment. Let us organize a search party. Let us, you know, get some diving gear. It would have never occurred to a navigator to call upon God to make that silly thing float. You know that? It would have never occurred to anybody. Say, well, why don't we ask God to have the thing float to the top? That is the difference, gang, between men of God and people who sit around thinking about second causes and always worrying about piddly little details rather than thrusting out and trusting God to work. That is the basic difference. These women, they knew there was a stone there, but it did not stop them. They pressed ahead, figuring somehow that silly stone is going to be rolled out of the way. And guess what? It was rolled out of the way, you know. God saw to that. That was God's business, not theirs. Leave to God what is God's. And let us do what God calls upon us to do. That stone was God's business, and they knew it. Somehow or other, they knew that. So off they went to anoint the body. I have a lot written on that, but I think I better stop at this point. But I think you may get the idea, see? So they go, and they find the stone gone. And so they find this person in his white garment. Verse 6, and he saith unto them, be not afraid. You seek Jesus of Nazareth, which was crucified. He is risen. He is not here. Behold the place where they laid him. But go your way, tell his disciples, and Peter, that he goeth before you into Galilee. There you shall see him, as he said unto you. Why and Peter? Because at this point, Peter was concerned, was convinced that he no longer had the right to be called a disciple. He had denied Jesus 3 times. He had totally blown it. He had swore and cursed and denied the name of Christ openly, publicly, 3 times. Do you think he may need a special word about this moment, you know? Do you think old Peter, way down in his heart, would probably need a little special encouragement? Well, that is the way God works. And so when he sends, he doesn't say, get his disciples together and tell them about this. See? Because God thinks in terms of individuals. God does not think in terms of the disciples. At this moment, God is thinking about Peter and some of Peter's needs and what Peter has gone through. And so he says here, now go your way, tell his disciples and Peter that he goeth before him to Galilee. Do you think that was an encouragement to old Peter's heart about this time? Man, I mean encouragement. See, that was a great encouragement to Peter. Look at verse 10. See, this had really gotten to these men, the fact that he was dead. And she went and told them that had been with him, and as they mourned and wept. See, mourned and wept. It had really hit them. See, so it's really in their hearts. So, tell Peter. Okay, one last thing on this business of training is the same chapter, verse 12. He's talking to these two men of Emmaus now, and you don't get much of the story, of course, from Mark. You never get much from Mark. He just kind of breezes over some things. But verse 12 says, after that he appeared in another form unto two of them as they walked and went into the country. Now these two, this little story is told us in Luke chapter 24, verse 32 and 45, if you're jotting down notes. But if you want to turn to chapter 24 of Luke and look at verse 32 and 45. Verse 32 says, and they said one to another, did not our heart burn within us while he talked with us by the way and while he opened unto us the scriptures? Verse 45 says, then opened he their understanding that they might understand the scriptures and said unto them. And there are two things that are affected by the way that Jesus taught his men. One was their heart, and the other was their head. Now, when you work with guys, or when you work with gals, make it a matter of prayer that when you share with people, not only their hearts or their heads will be affected, but both. There's an old preacher named Vance Havner, and I heard him preach one time. And he said, you know, I don't know which is worse, to have the facts without the fire or the fire without the facts. It's easy to have the fire without the facts. And it's also easy to have facts without the fire. When I went to Northwestern School in Minneapolis, where Billy Graham was the president, the motto of the school was knowledge on fire. The professors and so on there kind of did the teaching. And then Billy Graham would come whooping in one now and then and bring a little fire in its place, see? So it was kind of knowledge on fire. It was the motto of this school. And Billy was the president. It seems to me that as we share truth with people and help people grow, we should make it a daily matter of prayer that God will help us to share knowledge that is on fire, that will somehow affect the heart and the spirit. I got a lot I could say on that. It is very easy to get out a bunch of graphs and charts and overhead projectors and all kinds of teaching tools and do a great job. You know. But somehow, in all of that, we got to learn how to put the heart into the thing. It's also easy to sort of, you know, encourage and try to pep people up without having content. You know? Without not really know what you're talking about. I mean, getting down into the Word and feeding and studying so that you've got substance to share. Things that mean things that are there, you know, substance. So in our teaching, in our leading of people, let us pray that God will help us to share a truth that has a little heart and soul and spirit to it. But at the same time, let us be men and women of the Word who are down deep in the Word of God so that there's a substance there and not just all froth and, you know, surface stuff. But let us try to, you know, pray that God will give us that combination of knowledge on fire. And if somehow or other we can catch that, you know, people will really be helped. Because, you know, did our hearts burn within us? And then he opened their understanding. Their hearts and their heads were both affected. That, by the way, is one of the reasons why I follow Lauren Sammy. Just personal testimony. He's got more charts and graphs, you know, good night. He's got all these facts and figures, and he's so methodical. And it just challenges me to death. But at the same time, do you know what he does when he talks about this? He'll break down and cry. You ever seen him break down and cry? Of course we have, you know. He'll break down and cry. So it's not just charts and figures and facts and stuff with Lawrence Annie. He's got all of that. Great substance, great thought, that lawyer's mind of his, that analytical mind. But behind it all, there's a very tender, warm heart. So for this kid, that's the reason, that's one of the reasons I've trotted around behind that guy for lo these many years and will continue to. Because that's the kind of leadership I want. That, by the way, is what everybody's looking for. You know? Some guy that it's obvious that he's got kind of concern for them, and he's got something to share with them that'll help them. So, whatever it's worth, why, there's that.